The right-hander deals the 3-0. Green light for Hernandez, and he jolts one straight away center field and gone! An absolute rocket from the bat of Teoscar Hernandez.
Line, little squibber, it's got to go 10 yards, and it's close!
He's going to swing it again towards the end zone. Wide open is Brown. Touchdown. And another brilliant pass by Allen.
Trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis. 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good. Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers.
We didn't even get a Bryson DeChambeau highlight in there.
How good was he?
Well, how good was he compared to everybody else in the field? That course, I mean, you predicted it on Friday, Ziggy, and I don't think it wasn't anything that wasn't obvious to you or many, but what did we have? I had the winner at 5-under, which is what Justin Thomas was after Thursday's round.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were the closest.
Hugh had the winner at even par, and
I was in between.
You were in between, or you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was like a minus one or better. I figured somebody always kind of breaks away and can kind of shoot that even par. I thought the fact that Justin Thomas went 5-under in that first round gave me a glimpse of that. I believe a player will go under. Just the way that first day went. Greens were a little bit receptive. I still didn't play like it played hard, but DeChambeau, I mean, he figured out a way to take on the golf course. And I saw a lot of people tweeting yesterday saying, well, what are they going to do? Narrow the fairways even more, make the rough even thicker. The thing that the U.S. Open setup does is usually it forces the players to go and hit three wood and long irons more. DeChambeau said, no. Yeah. I'm going to pull out my driver even when I'm supposed to hit my three wood, get as far down as I can, and then I'm going to be the best out of the rough. That's what he did. He did the opposite of what players have done in the past.
Yeah, he didn't let the rough scare him. And
no.
And the fact that he's emerged in the last, year looking like Hulk Hogan.
Go and look at the way he looked a year ago to now. I mean, he put 40 pounds. You know what I mean? What'd he put on? 40 pounds? At least.
Yeah.
So what he's done, it's been incredible. He said, I have to become the biggest hitter in the game. Guys that hit it the longest are going to win. He figured that out, changed his body, changed his swing, brought in a different swing coach. Like it's crazy what he's done. I guess he's really changed his swing over the last 3-4 years, but this last year and a half has been crazy to see the transformation he's gone through.
I think he got on the blower with Tiger Woods at some point last year and said, hey, those Navy SEALs that you used to train with still got their number.
Yeah.
I mean, that dude bulked up and it paid off for him.
Yeah.
Now we got to talk about you. Are you okay?
My back's a little sore today.
Okay. Now,
my back is sore.
Okay. So when somebody tells me they got a sore back, I'm thinking they must have been out doing something. Right? Like
I
don't know. You come here every day, you got a problem with Doris out there. That tells me you're out in the garden. You're probably seeding the lawn or doing something that forces you to bend over every now and then. You can get a bit of a hitch in your back and it's not great. That's got to be it, right? You were out busy doing stuff and you hurt your back.
That I wish that was the case, but no, I mean, that's a big weekend of sports, is it not? I mean, U.S. Open, great football games on.
Don't distract from the conversation.
Okay, I'm sore from sitting on the couch.
Thank you.
I got glued to the couch, especially when golf's on. Golf, like, I love hockey. I love watching the Jays. I love my playoff NBA, but like when there is a major on for golf,
you're done.
I just can't get up. Like I'll go without eating. I can't leave the TV. Like, can you bring it to my couch, please, whenever I order food in? So yeah, it's bad, but what a great weekend. I mean, lots of sports, great action. I don't know what the highlight of the weekend was for you, or even if you had one, but I don't know. The golf did it for me. It would have been nice to see DeChambeau and Wolf go right down to the end. But he had it with seven holes. He had it locked up, the U.S. Open.
Yeah, it won by 8 strokes, and it was one of those old school Tiger majors where you just followed Tiger for 18 holes on a Sunday, knowing what the end result was going to be. Right?
Yeah.
He was up by X number of strokes, and you're just waiting for the guy in the red shirt to raise the trophy. Well, the NFL action yesterday, the Dallas game there's two games, I guess, that highlight everything. Dallas's comeback against Atlanta, which in so many ways, from the Falcons' perspective, is completely unacceptable. And then the Patriots and Seahawks going right down to the wire in last night, Sunday nighter in Seattle. And I was thinking about the Seahawks and how they got stuffed on a completed pass on the 1 yard line by the 49ers in the season ender last year that was for the NFC West division crown. And they end up stuffing Cam Newton on the goal line, final play of the game last night to win and to go to 2-0. So that was a crazy ending. And then that onside kick, the Dallas-Atlanta onside kick, Greg the Leg Zuerlein. Call me ignorant. I felt like I've paid pretty close attention to the NFL for the last 30 years or more. I don't think I've ever seen a kicker line up or place the football perpendicular to the 35-yard line for an onside kick with no tee. And then just squib it. I've seen squibs, but off of tees. He squibbed this thing, and I'm convinced the reason that the Atlanta Falcons didn't pick up the football was because they didn't think it was going to go 10 yards. And for the most of the way that ball traveled, it looked like it was going to settle about 5 yards from where it was kicked off. And then the spin just picked up speed. And everybody's standing there looking at it, and a white jersey, a Dallas Cowboys jersey, just falls on it. And Dallas down by 2 at that point. They don't have to go down and score a touchdown to win the football game. All they need is a field goal. And a couple of plays later, Dak Prescott and Zeke Elliott and the others had gotten them well, well down into field goal range. Greg the Leg Zuerlein is one of the longest kickers in the game, and he didn't need to be long. And Dallas wins. I mean, that was an incredible finish, and you know, because I'm following Cowboys, I got pals who are Cowboys fans, just whinging on Twitter, like, just why am I a fan of this team? I don't know why I've put myself through this for the last 25 years. How about damn Cowboys? And then
I couldn't believe the kick got there either. I don't remember seeing an onside kick off the ground before with no tee. I can't remember that once.
I'd never seen it. Maybe it's a new thing. I bet you it starts a trend. They love to
start
trends.
If they jump on the ball prior to the ball moving 10 yards.
Yes.
Then what?
Well, if they fall on the ball and possess it, it is theirs, and they run out the clock and the game is over.
That's what I was confused why they didn't jump on the ball.
Because there's a lot of English and spin on the ball. And the moment a Falcon touches the ball, it's live.
Yeah, so you're telling me you couldn't have jumped on that ball?
Well, you put your hands team out and all of that to make sure that the most capable of falling on it or catching it or doing whatever are out there. You don't put your big slugs out there. So yes, they should have been able to fall on it. But my point is, Ziggy, is the moment a Falcon touches that football, even if it's within the first 10 yards, if that ball gets loose, which is to say the English on it, you fall on it, and it gets away from you. Once it's touched a Falcon, it's open season for the Cowboys, even if it hasn't gone the 10 yards. So I think what Atlanta's doing is, man, there's a lot of weird spin on this ball, but it doesn't look like it's going to go 10 yards. So we're not going to touch it. And that way it'll just be dead on the field and it'll be ours. But then when the spin picked up and the English kicked in right at the end, and like it went from the 5 yard mark to the 10 yard mark and Dallas fell on it, they were stunned. I'm not defending the Atlanta Falcons, but what I'm saying is I can actually see the thought process there, as painful as it was.
I get it. It's just, why would you take a chance? Because as soon as that ball gets close to going 10 yards, that's going to be your least, that's going to be your lowest chances of actually recovering the ball once it hits the 10 yards. Did you see the Dallas team once that ball? I mean, they're licking their chops as soon as the ball was started turning a couple more revolutions, getting towards the 10 yard, moving 10 yards.
Well, they were prepared because that was their only hope.
Yeah.
They couldn't pick it up sooner. So they were prepared for it.
And Mike McCarthy, I think he was the most surprised, the Dallas coach, more than anyone when they asked him. Because he's like, yeah, oh yeah, we did this in practice. And they're like, when? Like, when did that actually happen? Yeah, I was like, oh yeah. He's like, oh yeah, 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 yeah. We, you know, it's never live game. I'm like, I don't know who's practicing that play. The kicker must practice it. He didn't just decide to do that on the spot.
No, he didn't.
No. So, hey, that was an exciting game. Dallas wins. Happy for them. Yeah, I have a lot of friends that are Cowboys fans. I don't get it. How are my Ravens, though? They look unstoppable.
Of course. Yeah. Well, they needed just that one extra fan to join the fold or the flock, right? They're your guys now. So this is what we're going to have to deal
flock.
With. This is what we're going to have to deal with every week. You walking in on a Monday morning after another Ravens win.
They're not a lock to be the best team in the league. Are they? They're not Super Bowl favorites. KC's the Super Bowl favorites. Like, come on.
They play next Monday. You know, Baltimore, Kansas City play next Monday.
I know. Next week. I can't wait.
So your new favorite team against one of your former favorite teams.
Yeah. I mean, Lamar, it's just, did you see him go in the end zone into, or not Lamar, who went into the end zone and tried the karate chop, and they asked him and he said,
it was Mark
Ingram. Ingram, and he said, I used to be a black belt. Like that. What was that? That was a backwards kick into like I didn't get it. So
they celebrated, man. That's
yeah. I don't know. I thought that was hilarious. The backward chop, but yeah, they look good. Not many holes there. I mean, next week will be a huge test, but yeah. How about KC? How about the Chiefs game? What did you think of
Harrison Butker, man? So you got a 53 yarder in a tie game to win it. Your team takes a procedure penalty, but you go through with the play and you hit it. Okay. So that moves you back to a 58 yarder because it's a 5 yard penalty. Then the Chargers ice you. Right at the last second,
love
they call
it.
The timeout.
I love the ice.
He puts
I
it,
love the timeout ice.
He puts oh it through. Gosh. He puts it through. And then he actually puts it through when it's the real kick. So he hit 3 53-plus yard field goals in the final moment of that game, the last of which was the one that counted. Mm-hmm. You talk about boning up. I mean, 58 ain't. That ain't a chip shot, dude. That's serious distance.
One off of what the record? Like who has the 59? The 59 record was who was that?
Well, there have been a few 60 plus in the NFL's history.
Yeah,
I think Kansas City's history. Nick Lowry, I think it tied him with Nick Lowry. But anyway, I mean that to be out there and Kansas City was my.
No, that's the second longest OT kick made in the NFL since 74. 59 was the longest.
In overtime. I thought you were talking about the
overtime. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Well, overtime, fourth quarter. I mean, it's a long kick. And Kansas City was my survival pool pick. So,
were you not scared? How good was Justin Hebert?
You know, it's Herbert, H-E-R-B-E-R-T.
Hebert,
H-E-B-E-R-T.
Is it Hebert or Herbert?
It's Come Herbert. On,
what is it?
It's Herbert. It's Herbert. Bobby Hebert was the old New Orleans Saints quarterback 30 years ago. H-E-B-E-R-T. That's who Costanza was talking about.
You know, it's Herbert.
Herbert.
H-E-R-B-E-R-T.
But it's Hebert.
Oh, my God. So it's Herbert. Okay.
This is what he does on. This is what he talks about on dates. Bobby Hebert and the pronunciation of his name. The other.
Anyways,
he also talks about toilet paper on dates. She was left and left.
Justin Hebert, Herbert, whatever you want to say. Cam was good in New England, but Justin Herbert was by far for me the biggest player story outside of all the injuries. I mean, can you believe what that rookie did just coming in? The thing is, he didn't know he was starting, right?
Didn't
know he was playing.
Tyrod Taylor went down in warmups.
Yeah, with the ribs. He re-aggravated his ribs. So, I mean, what a day for the kid. Looked comfortable, didn't panic. I did say, though, when they were up 17-9, when he threw the interception, I didn't like him going like, what do they say as a quarterback? Never go one way and throw back way across your body, right? That's a big no-no. As soon as he threw that interception, I thought it was over. I thought they were done.
Yeah. Very
like,
few.
I didn't even think it'd go to OT. Yeah.
Very few guys can do that with pinpoint accuracy. The guy who comes to mind is Aaron Rodgers, who can often flush out to his left and then throw across his body and hit a receiver coming across. But it's a big win for Kansas City because, look, I mean, I think they're going to win the AFC West going away, but you're looking for those home games in the playoffs. And you're going to have a Baltimore team that probably loses two or three games at most. And if you kick one early in the season, well, that slims your margin for error on that front. The one thing that, as we circle back to Seattle, New England, that caught my eye last night, and I've tracked this now for a couple of years, Ziggy, but it hit me in the face, was Steve Belichick. So Bill Belichick's kid is a coach for the Patriots.
Mm-hmm.
As an assistant, he's the outside linebackers coach. How many outside linebackers coaches in the NFL get camera time?
Approximately
zero. He's not the inside linebackers coach. He's not the coach of all of the linebackers. He is the outside linebackers coach. And in a 3-4 defense, you'd have two of them. But because his last name is Belichick, he gets camera time.
I thought it was because of his hair.
That Kentucky waterfall is something. So
hair is bad. Like, is he serious with the hair?
He was born. He's 30.
Oh, is it something he was born with?
No.
Like a problem with his hair? Oh.
What?
I don't know.
What, he was born
I don't know.
With
I thought you were going to go with like.
No. I said, I was going to say he was born in. Born with a problem with his hair.
He's born with a mullet.
Yeah, he was born with a rat tail down to his ass. I mean, he's the demon spawn of William Belichick, I mean, after all.
Man.
No, so he's 33 years old. He was born in Ridgewood, New Jersey. Now, of all the states where that haircut would be a thing, I don't think New Jersey's at the top of the list. And then, of course, he would have grown up from, 13 or so in New England because his dad's been the coach there for 20 years.
And that's not a thing there. I live there. I live right by Foxborough.
Okay.
That's not a thing.
It's not a thing. Those mullets
No.
are not a thing? All right.
No.
Well, we have confirmation of that then. That is not a New England look.
No.
That is not a Boston, Mass, Foxborough, Mass look. But I threw it up on Twitter last night. the Mark Davis, the owner of the Las Vegas Raiders. He's got the Lloyd Christmas bowl cut. And Steve Belichick, who's got the worst haircut? And it's a poll question up on Twitter. It's Scotty Mac thanks to Mike Zygmantis at UW Burl. Oh, he got more than 1,500 votes. 82% say Mark Davis, the bowl cut.
Mark Davis over the...
People are giving love.
Mullet?
People are giving love to the power mullet.
Yeah, I don't know. You're saying what's worse, or what would you rather have?
What's a worse haircut? So what would you rather not have? The Mark Davis bowl cut or the Steve Belichick power mullet?
I don't know. I think I'd go with the mullet too. I'd like the mullet. I'd go with the mullet instead of the Davis haircut, because the Davis haircut, that's just bad. How do you fix that? The mullet.
Well, you fix it by shaving. You go down to the wood.
Yeah. I know, but with the mullet, you just trim the back up a little bit, and you're ready to go.
You can recover.
I mean, that's not like his mullet is shaved on the top and then dangling out the back. It's pretty thick on the top and thick down the back.
What do you think Thanksgiving dinner's like in the Belichick household?
Do you think his dad says, "What are you thinking?"
No, you know, like, here's what I think his dad says when the hair comes up.
We got a huge game this week against a great football team, a great organization, and that's where it all is going forward on Seattle.
That's all he's thinking about. Bill Belichick, he's not thinking about his son's hair. He's thinking about
Seattle.
Yeah, thinking about Seattle. On to Cincinnati. On to the next team.
Well,
but dad would be glaring, though. Dad would be glaring going, dude, you're a New Jersey kid living in Boston. And you're walking around with that squirrel tail on.
Yeah, it's a bad look. He's got to change that up, especially if they're going to show him on TV all game. Like, come on.
But he doesn't care anymore either. It's not like he's not out on the scene, man. He's married. He's locked in. He's not impressing anyone.
What'd you think of Belichick's face mask? It was kind of that's a weird face mask, is it not?
It's very.
And I was like, a buddy messaged me. He goes, "Is that a beak or a bill?" And I'm like, "Funny."
Oh God.
But I don't know. The masks are just they're hilarious. I mean, on Belichick, he's got that little beak, and then Andy Reid. I mean, how much play is Andy Reid?
Did he do the face shield against? I didn't see any Kansas City Chargers game. So,
well, I'm going to tell you this. I'm going to say it didn't fog up once. I think he applied some anti-fogger to it.
Yeah, he put some no-fog spray.
Yeah, no fog spray. Or you do a little bit of the shampoo on the inside. You just rub it and you kind of wipe it off so it's not sticky or anything. That's kind of what you do.
But what do you think's going on the inside of that, though? He starts talking, and if he's got part of the pregame meal in between his teeth and he just starts screaming at one of his coaches in the headset...
I will say
and
this.
All of a sudden, he's got little food particles on the...
I will say this, though. If you're a player and the coaches have bad breath, I'm sure they're loving the fact that he's got that shield now. Because then you don't get the bad breath, right? Because I've had some coaches, oh my goodness me, they needed about 89 breath mints, because as soon as you get close to them, it's just disgusting.
Was it straight up halitosis, or was it straight up you could tell they drank a pot of coffee straight from the pot?
Yeah, I've had some coaches where their breath's been so bad, you're begging for the coffee breath, like brutal. So when I started coaching a couple years ago, always make sure a couple mints in before you go, because you never want to talk to one of the guys on the bench and you know you have the bad breath. But I'm sure guys are just. Thank God he's got the shield on, so they don't have to smell his breath anymore.
You made your way through it, though, and that's what counts. you're still here.
But that was an exciting game, though.
Yeah, it was absolutely
the Chiefs Chargers. Casey didn't really Mahomes didn't have it going on the first half. I don't know what was going on. Hill wasn't his usual self, and then the game just got awesome.
But that's a sign of a good team, though. You don't have it. You go out on the road. You don't have it. And you still find a way to gut it out, grind it out, and get the victory. And Kansas City, certainly that. Ross Tucker of the Ross Tucker Football Podcast will join us at the top of the 8 o'clock hour, as he always does on a Monday. And we'll go through the week 2 action in the NFL. One of the stories Ziggy and I have not touched on yet are all the injuries. And in particular, the injuries in the 49ers-Jets game and a lot of chatter about the slickness of the turf at MetLife Stadium. The New York Giants were on the road yesterday in Chicago. They lost. They also lost their star running back Saquon Barkley to a torn ACL, so they will not have him next week at MetLife when they host the 49ers. The Niners are in a weird spot right now where they are playing two consecutive road games in the same stadium. And a lot of 49ers players who survived yesterday's game are questioning whether they should be playing on that turf. Christian McCaffrey got hurt. Drew Lock, the rookie quarterback of Denver, got hurt in their game at Pittsburgh. Davante Adams with a hammy in Green Bay. So a lot going on that we've got to discuss with Ross Tucker, and we will do that. John Paul Morosi at 7:30. Stephen Brunt. We'll get into the Blue Jays with both of them. The magic number. The Jays actually won yesterday, broke the six-game losing skid. Their magic number to clinch a playoff spot is 4. So that means any combination of Blue Jays wins and Seattle Mariners losses that add up to 4 puts the Blue Jays in the playoffs. And with just a week left in the season, it is all but certain that the Blue Jays will be playing in one of those 3-game playoff play-in series. Bill Daly is the deputy commissioner of the NHL on the success of the bubble and on what this offseason and next season could look like. He will join us at 8:30. We'll get in-depth on the state of the NHL with the deputy commissioner, Bill Daly. Hughes just sat down. We'll burl the lead with the Washington football team's number one fan. Next. Now I got $400 in Nantucket gift cards to attempt to give away. Woo-hoo. But later, we'll do that in 20 minutes or less. So be listening for your cue to call. Stephen Brunt, John Morosi, Ross Tucker, Bill Daly, the deputy commissioner of the NHL, all ahead on the program this morning. Here is Hugh to burl the lead.
Good Monday morning, fellas. Hope you had a nice weekend. Oh, before we start, why is Ziggy's back sore again?
For the very same reason that there's a deep indentation on his couch.
U.S. Open.
I hear you. I hear you, brother. My back
NFL
is sore, too.
Sunday, Jays, yeah. Hockey.
My back is sore, too, Ziggy, but that's because I took over 200 swings on the golf course this weekend.
Oh,
yeah.
Man, that's a tough day.
It is. So you took over 200.
2 days.
Oh, that's 2 days of strokes. 2 days.
I was going to say, just another Saturday morning out on the course for you.
Oh, my goodness. It was bad. All right, boys, here we go. All the talk leading up to the U.S. Open at Winged Foot was about the treacherous, ankle-hiding rough and how tough it would be for players to chop their way out of it to have any chance. And it was exactly like that for everybody not named Bryson DeChambeau.
Bryson DeChambeau is indeed a U.S. Open champion at Winged Foot.
Not only did DeChambeau chop out, he also mastered the crazy greens en route to a 6-stroke win over Matthew Wolff in his first major championship. DeChambeau was the only player to finish under par. He only hit 23 of 56 fairways all week. That's the lowest number of any U.S. Open winner, but when you can muscle it out like he can, that doesn't matter. DeChambeau was asked if this win validates his bomb and gouge style of play.
No doubt, no doubt. For me, it's about the journey of, can I execute every shot more repeatably than everybody else? And I was able to do that this week, and that's why I won by 6. There are different ways to do things. And if you can find your own way, find your passion, like Arnie said, swing your swing. That's what I do. That's what Matthew Wolff does. That's what Tiger does. That's what Phil does. That's what everybody does, and we're all trying to play the best golf we can.
Is that a bit of a jab there at the entire field? That's why I won by 6.
He sounds like he's applying for a Major League Baseball front office position after his golf career.
Yes.
Tires the words he uses.
Very scientific approach. Rory McIlroy finished 12 shots back at plus 6. Like the rest of us, he was stunned by DeChambeau's performance.
I don't really know what to say because that's just the complete opposite of what you think a U.S. Open champion does. look, they, you know, he's found a way to do it. Whether that's good or bad for the game, and I don't know, but it's just it's not the way I saw this golf course being played or this tournament being played, and just can't really wrap my head around it.
Interesting. So the last five U.S. Open winners: DeChambeau, Gary Woodland, Brooks Koepka with two, and Dustin Johnson. What do they all have in common? They're huge hitters off the tee. So short guys don't have a chance anymore, do they?
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely changed the way you approach the game. There's no golf course in the world where the longer you drive it, the better your scores are going to be, right? It's all about accuracy, and the U.S. Open is typically that tournament where the most accurate players off the tee will win. The one course that's an exception is Augusta, where they're playing the next two majors at the Masters. So, yeah, I think a lot of players have to look at the way he approached it, and it's, what was he averaging, 325 off the tee?
Yeah, something like that.
Not his biggest drive. That's an average. Huge.
But those stats are only counted on the fairway. So drives are only counted on the fairway. So if it goes into the rough, which most of his drives did, we don't know like what he would have averaged if you count all of them.
He changed his approach, because I said earlier, Hugh, it's most guys when they come to U.S. Open, the rough's that thick, they play defensive.
Yeah.
And then it's, instead of a three wood, it's a long iron. Instead of a driver, it's a three wood. He just said, you know what? I'm going to grip it and rip it, and I'm going to put as far down there as I can, and I'm going to rely on my wedge, on my iron game out of the thick rough. And that's what really separated him. It was the talk around he's putting well or he's driving it far. No, his irons were good out of the long stuff. He didn't get into any trouble.
Yeah.
That's what separated him.
Yeah, and his advantage, Ziggy, wasn't the fact that he could just hit it far into the rough. It was the fact he's the only guy strong enough out of anybody on tour to chop it out of there with a reasonable chance at birdie or par. He's just so big and so strong, so he has an advantage. Before the tournament, he said, I don't hit many fairways anyway. I'm not going to hit many anyway this weekend, so I'm just going to bomb it down there as far as I can. And that's exactly what he did. And everybody else, they're throwing their hands up. They feel helpless right now. See, that course was set up to punish that type of approach. Bryson DeChambeau didn't care. But he's the only one with the luxury of not caring, because he's the only one that can get out of it like that.
I would like to see them at 300 yards off the tee is make the rough even thicker. So instead of making it thick the farther away you get sideways from the from the fairway, make it at like 250 and 300 and three. Make it deeper the farther down you go. Yeah. Almost open up the fairway, but make the rough even
like a graduated more of a rough the further you go down the fairway. Yeah,
down, but that would be tough to do for the groundskeeper.
By the way, poor guys working hard enough. By the way, the top Canadian was Taylor Pendrith at plus 10. Oh yeah, he was third in driving distance. He's a huge hitter at 332 yards averaging. Ouch. Tough Sunday in the NFL if you like your players healthy. So many injuries. San Fran hit particularly hard. Sorry, Scotty, man. Nick Bosa, torn ACL. Raheem Mostert, Solomon Thomas, Jimmy Garoppolo. Saquon Barkley of the Giants, torn ACL. He's likely done for the year. Christian McCaffrey, the Panthers. On the field, there were some great calls. Let's begin in Big D, where the Cowboys fell behind 20-0 in the first, but they chipped away, trailing 39-37. They lined up for the onside kick.
Zerline, little squib, it's got to go 10 yards, and it's close.
Scotty, you guys were talking about this earlier. Somebody's got to jump on that ball.
Somebody's got to jump on it, but with all the English and all the spin, I can put myself in Atlanta's shoes. They don't think, as that ball moves toward the left sideline at a very slow pace, they don't think it's going to pick up the way that it did, and they think it's going to fall short of the 10-yard mark, And because of that, they're saying, well, we're not going to touch it. Because if we touch it, then it's a live ball for either side.
Yeah.
And how many times have we seen through the years onside kicks that have been muffed by the receiving team, gets through a guy, or it's picked up and fumbled or some kind of thing. So they're figuring, this isn't going 10 yards. We'll just stay away.
Yeah.
Then the English on that ball picks it up. It starts moving, and Dallas is there to pounce.
Yep.
And they didn't need a touchdown to win. They were down 2 points.
Yep.
And field goal
did. Zuerlein kicked the winning.
And Zuerlein, I don't think it was that long a kick. I don't know the exact number, 35, 38, whatever it was, yardage. He could have kicked a 52. He's got a long leg. So
Greg leg.
Once Dallas recovered, I was like, we know where this is going.
Yeah, fun happens when the ball isn't round, that's for sure. Chiefs and Chargers went to overtime, tied at 20. KC kicker Harrison Butker lined up for the game-winning kick. False start. Penalty. Moved him back 5 yards. Lined up again. Timeout Chargers to freeze him out. No problem. Third time's the charm from 58 yards.
He's had plenty of leg on the first two attempts. Butker's kick is up. He lines it up. The kick is long enough. It is good! Harrison Butker, money, 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 penalty. Try to freeze him. He thaws the Chargers with a 23-20 walk-off 58-yard field goal, tying a Chiefs record.
Yeah, surprising thing about that game is the fact that the Chargers took the Chiefs to overtime. Chiefs 2-0 in the season. Nice game, nice day for the Steelers' Canadian rookie receiver, Chase Claypool.
Roethlisberger back, looks out to his left, lost one along the sideline, going for Chase Claypool, who catches it in stride. Claypool stays in bounds, crosses the 20, the 15, the 10. The rookie Chase Claypool in for his first NFL touchdown, 84 yards. Roethlisberger to Claypool.
Oh, you always remember your first. 86 yards receiving for Claypool, 84 of them on that one play. In two games, he's been targeted 5 times. He's made 5 catches, 112 receiving total yards. This kid's good. We shouldn't be surprised, but
no, we shouldn't be.
It's nice to see him be an important part of that offense.
Right? Yeah, and Big Ben, who is back after getting injured in week 2 last year, he's getting down to his last hurrah. And I would think by the time that the AFC North has organized itself, it'll be a Baltimore-Pittsburgh deal. The Ravens, I would think, are the better team. But the Steelers will have something to say with it. The Steelers are one of those bellwether franchises in the league.
Yeah. By the way, Tom Brady's Bucks, they looked better yesterday.
Well, Carolina also sucks.
Yeah, well, McCaffrey out too.
And they got, they lost McCaffrey.
How about the Bills? 31-28 over the Dolphins. Bills are 2-0. Good
you
stuff.
You know, big thing there, Josh Allen.
Yeah.
Josh Allen had a monster day and was finding Stephon Diggs. If that connection works, and don't think Stephon Diggs isn't looking at Kirk Cousins' stats in the Minnesota Indy game going, I'm in the right place. But if Josh Allen finds it, I'm telling you, this Bills team is going to win the AFC East. And if Josh Allen becomes the guy, which is to say he becomes a more accurate passer, anything's possible for Buffalo.
Yeah, he can do it with his legs. It's nice to see him do it with the arms, too. By the way, Kyler Murray. Oh, my goodness. That kid is exciting to watch. He's so good.
He's got both my team and your team in the first 2 weeks of the season, Hugh. You don't need to tell me that.
Yeah, he's a good one.
Yeah,
man, he's shifty. He can run. He can throw. I mean,
And Ziggy's hooking up with DeAndre Hopkins too. I mean, that is a lethal combination right now.
Oh, so, yeah. He's a special player. I love the move he made for when he ran it in. Breaking ankles.
As a Washington fan, that was great. Dramatic finish to the Lakers-Nuggets game 2. L.A. trailing by 1 with seconds to go.
Trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis, 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good! Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers!
105-103 L.A. the final. They have a 2-0 series lead over Denver. The Heat lead the Celtics 2-1. Game 4 tomorrow. The NHL, Tampa looks to even up the Stanley Cup final at a game apiece tonight, 8 o'clock on Sportsnet and CBC. And NHL Deputy Commissioner Bill Daly joins us at 8:30 this morning. What do you want to ask him about?
I'm going to ask him, here's my first question. True pro, where do you think Alex Pietrangelo is going to end up? No, I'm not going to ask him that.
Are we surprised?
Yay or nay, Bill Daly? Will Alex Pietrangelo, should we yay or nay him?
Yes, we can.
You could. He'd play along.
Let's do it.
We got to, not with Pietrangelo.
No,
we,
no.
We got to come up with a real question here to yay or nay him.
Yeah. Are we surprised that the Lightning are down 1-0 in this series? I mean,
my stars have been good. But
oh, stop it, please.
Everyone's talking about Vasilevsky being the best goaltender in the NHL. I think Khudobin is the best goaltender in the NHL.
Right now, for sure, yeah. He's been great.
Like, no, but even if you look at his numbers over the last 3 years, they're incredible.
Okay, I will.
Like, his last 3 years, his save percentage and goals against, I know he's not your typical number one starter, right? He only gets about half the games, but his numbers stack him against anyone in the league, and they're right there. So the fact that Vasilevsky is supposed to be this superior goaltender to him, I mean, he played well in game one, Vasilevsky, but Khudobin outplayed him. That's it.
You need to be Hudobin's agent. You need to start putting GIFs and memes out there on Twitter. You need to Alan Walsh it up for Anton Khudobin. See if you can't get him the Vasilevsky $8 or $9 million a year.
Yeah.
All right, we'll open up the phone lines now. 416-870-0590. 416-870-0590. We play All or Nothing for Untuckit gift cards. We give away $100 in Untuckit gift cards each day. But if we don't have a winner, the number carries over. And we're on a three-game losing skid. $400 in Untuckit gift cards. Up for grabs today. Get to calling because we play next. Didn't have a winner Wednesday. Didn't have a winner Thursday. Didn't have a winner Friday. We got $400 in Untuckit gift cards up for grabs. We play All or Nothing. Three true or false questions. You got to get them all right or get them all wrong. So if you get the first one wrong, get questions 2 and 3 wrong on purpose. It's a big day. If Marcello and Woodbridge wins, he will never tuck his shirt in again. Marcello, good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Yourself?
We are excellent. And we don't want you to tuck ever again. So we wish you good luck. Good luck. Thanks. Ziggy.
I don't want to tuck either.
Question number one, pal.
It was a wild 40-39 win by the Cowboys over the Falcons yesterday. Dak Prescott had more rushing touchdowns than any player on either team, including Elliott and Gurley. True or false?
True.
That's correct. He had 3. Elliott had 1, and the Falcons had 0. No other QB has thrown for 400 yards and also rushed for 3 TDs.
So it was a good day to have Dak as your fantasy football quarterback. Okay, so Marcello, you're in good shape. Get the next 2 correct, and the gift cards are yours.
Marcello, are you a golf fan?
I love playing it, but I don't watch it too much.
All right, okay. Well, hopefully you paid attention to the U.S. Open. Marcello. Bryson DeChambeau was the only golfer at the U.S. Open to finish under par. Is that true or is that false?
That is true.
Oh, yes, it is. He was -6. Matt Wolf was even. Louis Oosthuizen was 3rd at +2.
Marcello, you're a Leafs fan?
I'm a huge Leafs fan, okay. So I better get this right.
All right, so do you go back long enough to remember when Grant Fuhr was a Maple Leaf? Here's the question. Grant Fuhr is 58 years old today. Happy 58th to the great Grant Fuhr. When the Maple Leafs traded for him to bring him to Toronto, there was a goalie who went to the Oilers, so who went the other way in that trade. And that goalie was Alan Bester. True or false?
Mr. Alan Bester. False.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Marcello is winning. Because it was Peter Ng.
Hey.
Who went the other way?
I'll do the terrible puns on the show, okay?
Peter Ng.
You know who won't be tucking ever again?
There was a Leaf event.
Were you golfing?
Were you golfing? Yeah.
With Peter Ng?
Yeah, I'm not sure if he was playing. It was like
playing?
Please stop.
Okay. So Hugh is our bellwether for this.
Yes.
When Hugh says stop, it's over.
Because I do the terrible puns.
Oh, I'm stealing your gimmick.
I know terrible puns.
So you played with golf with Peter.
I didn't play with him. He was at the place. This is weeks ago.
There you go. Well, Peter Ng was the goalie. That trade was Grant Fuhr, Glenn Anderson, and Craig Berube, now the head coach of the St. Louis Blues, to Toronto for Vinny Domfus, Peter Ng, Luke Richardson, and Scott Thornton.
Hmm.
$400 in Nantucket gift cards to Marcello. Congratulations, and thank you for listening. We'll give away $100, or at least attempt to, when we play All or Nothing at this time tomorrow morning. It's a jam-packed show. NHL Deputy Commissioner Bill Daly at 8:30. Ross Tucker for his weekly NFL Week 2 recap. John Paul Morosi at 7:30. Stephen Brunt on the Leafs' potential pursuit of Alex Pietrangelo. The Blue Jays' magic number dwindling to 4, even though they're hardly winning these days. And whatever else comes up, the great Stephen Brunt next. Time to play another game of what's going on in Ziggy's living room. You're in the mosh pit, brother.
When a good tune comes on, you gotta jam.
Happy Bruno Caboclo Day. We're 2 days away from being 2 days away to the end of the week.
All right.
The Blue Jays' magic number is 4.
So when you say that, you mean a combination of Jays wins or
Mariners losses that add up to four.
How about the other teams?
Well, the magic number for the Blue Jays with the Orioles and Tigers, I believe, is 3 because they're further behind than Seattle is. So Seattle, it's always your magic number is always the number of wins for you and losses for them, them being the team that is closest to the playoffs, but on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
So a combination of Blue Jays wins and Mariners losses that adds up to 4 secures the Blue Jays a playoff spot. Now, this magic number is not entirely something over which to obsess because let's just put it out there. The Jays are going to the playoffs. There's no way that Seattle is going to catch them. And if they do, I'm not going to commit to getting a Steven Belichick haircut. I'm not going to do that to myself. I'm not going to.
Yeah. Why don't we put something on?
Ridiculously interesting in an uncomfortable way. The Jays are going to the playoffs.
Let's put something on it. You were so adamant about it a couple weeks ago. Let's make it worth something.
Okay. Well, we'll have to give that some thought. I'm not doing the Steven Belichick though.
Steve Belichick. That's not a bad haircut.
Speaking of Stevens, here's Mr. Brunt, one of the co-hosts of Writer's Block, 3 to 5, right after Baseball Central here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Hey, Scotty, how you doing?
Well, I'm good. I haven't locked myself into risking a Steve Belichick haircut. That is a pretty good Kentucky waterfall, though.
It is a Kentucky waterfall. I like that. Yeah. I hope he... Did he lose a bet? Like, did he know?
He's worn that thing for 2 years, so if he lost a bet, he's been paying over time.
It's not everyone can carry that look off.
No. Put it that way. Not many. And I don't think he can, but he doesn't seem to care.
Yeah.
So what do you make of the week that has been for the Blue Jays, Steven? I chalk it up to this. This is a playoff team in an awkward season. but over 162 games, they would not be. And they're still in a place where sometimes the ugly side of things is going to look quite ugly. And that would be underscored by the fact that the Yankees, a 100-plus-year-old franchise, set a bunch of franchise records against them last week. Just one of those things.
Yeah, well, several things, right? Look, the Jays are not a finished product. And even, you know, when they get into the playoffs this year, they're going to be a kind of a 500-ish team, which was what a lot of people kind of were hoping for or thinking in the spring. A 500-ish team in 162 with two wild cards might get you in the race. Again, it could get you a second wild card, but they probably are not a playoff team over 162. But that's okay, right? It's about the progression and the evolution of the team. And you see there, you know, every once in a while you see the flaws and you see the holes in that lineup. And, you know, I think it's been a nervous few days. It felt like a pennant race. And that game yesterday, you know, winning that game yesterday and then kind of watching the scoreboard to see what Seattle would do, that felt like a pennant race. And I think you got a bunch of guys on this team. You know, you only got a couple of guys who've ever been in a postseason. And I think they, for the first time, they froze a little bit against the Yankees. But let's roll back. The Yankees are really good. They started 26-6. You know, they had a dip in the middle. They had some real bad injuries. But it's not impossible that they are the best team in baseball right now, whatever their record says. So, yeah, they got clobbered. And it was a historic clobbering. And I think there was some hangover going into the first games of the Philly series. But I none of this to me is, like, if this turns into 1987, that'll be unfortunate. And we'll be discussing it for a while, and we'll talk about what it means in terms of next year. But if they get into the playoffs and, you know, get in a best 2 out of 3 against somebody, and we'll see what happens. That's all of those things are positive developments if you kind of look at the curve of this iteration of the Blue Jays. And they're going to have to address some stuff in the offseason. You see where some of the holes are. You see where they're thin. But none of that, like, again, unless if there's somebody out there who said this is the year, you know, back in March, I guess they would be disappointed right now. I don't think anybody else should be disappointed at the possibility of a postseason appearance and, you know, seeing what the young guys can do. Like, there's individual parts of the team where you can go, yes, that is disappointing to me. I wish I'd seen more over these almost 60 games. But stepping back and looking at the whole picture, it's a positive, right? It's the whole thing's a positive.
Yeah, and I'd actually, we'll get into a couple of those players that come to mind as you say that, but just quickly, because I'm going to get greedy here, and I want them to win a best of three playoff series. Like, so, yeah, so from a matchup perspective, do you have a thought on whether the quote preferred opponent would be Tampa Bay? I can't imagine it would be, just given the history. The Chicago White Sox, the Oakland A's factor in, potentially Josh Donaldson and the Twins, were they to overtake the White Sox? A lot of possibilities. Is there a quote preferred opponent?
I think it could still be, you know, again, I'm not sure it's mathematically possible for it still to be the Yankees.
But, 3.5 you know, back, so it's unlikely, yeah. But possible.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, look, they play Tampa tough this year, and Tampa's really hard to play against, obviously, and they can do a lot of. They're very creative, and they use their talent, and certain, you know, they have not had dominant starting pitching this year, but they have been done extremely well considering they haven't had dominant starting pitching for most of the year. But like, I don't. It doesn't really. I'm not gonna say it doesn't matter, but you go into that series, what you need is Ryu to have a great start in game one and win game one, and then you got a shot. You know, that's kind of how it plays out. Like, I think Taiwan Walker just won the game two start yesterday. I think we can write that one in pen, and we'll see what Shoemaker looks like. But I think the third game, if they got to a third game, would be a piggyback probably anyway. But I think it all comes down to Ryu, and he could beat anybody if he's at his absolute best. And, you know, the back end of the bullpen is a bit of a question mark right now with you know, Giles is gone, and, you know, Delise is hurt, and, you know, Romano, I don't think, is going to be back before the end of the year. So you don't quite have the faith in the back end. It looks a bit, you know, they look a bit frayed. But I think that applies to any of those matchups. That if you go in and win game one behind Ryu, you got a chance. You know, maybe not a great chance, but still a chance. There's, you know, they're all pretty good teams. And if you go into game one and lose behind Ryu, you're probably done.
Taijuan Walker pitched six innings yesterday. Thought he looked great. Is this one of those things where, you know, we've heard them not happy with not pitching as deep into games as they'd like, and, you know, it's send a message to Montoya, or is this just the fact that it was a one-off, he played well, and he got to see more innings?
Well, I think Charlie's, you know, using the numbers that, you know, that which everybody in baseball, a lot of people in baseball are using right now, which says don't let anybody go through a lineup three times. But there are exceptions to that. And obviously Ryu is an exception to that when he's feeling good and he's efficient. And I think, you know, Walker yesterday was efficient, and, you know, there were reasons. And plus the bullpen, again, is worn down. I'm not sure that it's not like you can... You want to have to cover 12 outs with the bullpen right now if you can help it. So Walker gave him that option yesterday with the way he pitched and by being relatively efficient. You know, pitchers can't throw 100 pitches anymore. But, you know, like Tanner Roark essentially made the case for everybody, you know, mm-hmm. after complaining about being yanked. And then, you know, look what happened when they let him go through a lineup the third time again. It's the numbers don't lie. But I think, you know, I think what Taijuan Walker did, the start previous was one of the shellings against the Yankees. But that was the inning where it blew up for him. I thought he looked really good until the mistakes started happening behind him, and they gave the Yankees five outs. And, you know, his pitch count went up, and he kind of ran out of gas in that inning. I thought up until that point, you know, if people catch fly balls in the outfield, you know, do kind of routine things in the outfield, he gets through that inning cleanly, and then you don't know where he's going to go. But yeah, I think he's earned the second spot in the postseason, maybe by default, but I think it's his. And, you know, look, I'm sure Charlie would love to not have to think about yanking him after the second time through the lineup in a playoff game, because it would mean that he was rolling and, you know, mean that he had things under control.
Stephen Brunn is our guest on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. What do you think, this is not so much for this week or next week into the playoffs, Stephen, what do you think the Blue Jays do with their catching heading into 2021?
It's a really good question, because it's an organizational strength on one, you know, in terms of volume. They've got like four or five catching prospects that they like.
Right, and Kirk has the possibility of becoming a cult hero.
He does. Yeah. We have to see more. And, you know, look,
of course. Yeah.
You can't, like, the guy hadn't caught above a ball before this year. So
yes.
Who knows? But I love him like everybody else loves him. They've got a lot invested in Danny Jansen, and, you know, Danny Jansen hit in the minors. Well, once he got his glasses, he hit everywhere in the minors and hasn't hit in the major leagues. But, you know, that does happen to young catchers sometimes, because the other part of the game is so demanding. They've got, who else they got? Riley Adams. They've got, who's the guy in their top 10? Mercado.
Mm-hmm.
They've got one of their top 10 prospects as a catcher. You know, those kind of veteran guys like Caleb Joseph are out there. If you wanted to, you know, again, anoint one of your young guys and bring in an insurance policy, I would assume they would still have an insurance policy next year. But, you know, like I say, Danny Jansen, there will be a point. Like, I think Reese McGuire, I don't know that we'll ever see Reese McGuire in a Blue Jay uniform again. Because there are other options among the catching prospects.
Yeah. I don't know if we need to go back into this, but do you think the thing that happened in Florida just sort of set this year on a brutal mark?
Who knows?
Yeah. Like, because he couldn't hit a lick. Right.
Yeah,
and offense was never his thing. Really, he was more of a defensive guy.
I was going to say, Scott. Yeah, it's a bit of an illusion. Like last year was a bit of an illusion, I think, offensively, that he hit a little bit better at the major. When a guy hits better in the major leagues than he has in the minors, it's probably an aberration. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what happened with him. So, you know, if you look at his entire minor league log, you know, he's a very good defensive catcher who doesn't hit. And there's lots of those in baseball. And guys make, you know, you can have a pretty long career being one of them. But I just think because they've got they've got some other guys they want to look at here. It's hard to see him getting to the front of the line again.
Yeah, like, because I'm putting this together in my head. So Bo is, I think Bo's a great player. Teoscar has got a near 1,000 OPS, and it's just good that he's back. They need that bat in the middle of the order. I think Lourdes Gurriel Jr., for what he has done over the last year and a half calendar-wise since being permanently moved out of the infield, that's been under discussed. He is a very, very good major league hitter. And then Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is somebody that you hope just figures it out and continues to improve. I've identified four core pieces there. You got Ryu at the top of the rotation. I would imagine Nate Pearson next year, if things are relatively normal, as a starting pitcher. And let's just pretend, for the sake of this conversation, he's healthy. If you go and get somebody to either slot in behind Ryu and Pearson or slot in between for the time being Ryu and Pearson, such that you've got a 1-2-3 in your starting rotation that you really like, you might just have something there. I wonder if we're getting close to that time, Stephen, where Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins look and say, got a ton of catchers, got a ton of middle infielders amongst our prospect capital. We're going to spin a trade here to go and get a controllable arm, somebody who might be expensive or getting expensive in arbitration eligibility, but somebody who we've got for sure for 2 or 3 years at least, and then maybe we can sign them. But go and get a consequential arm to shore up the pitching and really try to take that next step heading into next year.
I think that's exactly what you do. You can look at the, you know, people can look at the free agent market. Trevor Bauer is going to be a free agent. You know, he wants 1 year deals apparently. And you get a lot with Trevor Bauer, in addition to the pitching. So you'd have to think about that. But look, the whole prospect thing is, you know, especially, you know, becoming a fan in this era rather than a fan back in the day. But it's, you know, so much of it is about kind of dreaming on prospects, right? And we know way more about them than we used to as they advance towards the major leagues, and people kind of project, you know, like I can guarantee you 99.9% of Blue Jays fans have never seen Jordan Groshans play.
Right.
But they know all about him, and they know, well, where's he going to, you know, is he going to be a third baseman, or how's this going to work, and, you know, how are they going to shuffle things around, or, you know, where's Austin Martin going to play, or, you know, but one of the big reasons you acquire prospect capital is to deal it, to wheel it and deal it at a certain point, and deal from your areas of strength to shore up your areas of weakness. And, you know, the timing is really important. And, you know, look, if you want to look back to 2015 and what Alex Anthopoulos did, they, you know, he wheeled a bunch of guys who, you know, the Daniel Norrises and the Jeff Hoffmans and, you know, guys who we had talked about as potential, you know, mainstays in the Blue Jay rotation. But, you know, they felt like they had enough rotational depth at that point that they could, and, you know, those guys haven't panned out, and that's exactly what you want to happen, right? You figure the guy out before anybody else figures him out. But, yeah, I think this, they're going to hope that part of their rotation next year is made up by some combination of Nate Pearson and, you know, Julian Mayweather or Anthony Kay or Thomas Hatch or, you know, any of those. There's a bunch of guys in there who are really interesting who are starters. Plus, you know, the Alec Manoahs and Patrick Murphy's another guy. Like, so, but you don't want to force, you don't want four of your five guys to be them. And I don't know what they're going to do with Tanner Roark. You know, they got another year of him. He looked, you know, I haven't seen anything there this year. You know, you could go out and you could try and sign Taijuan Walker if you wanted. He's a free agent if you like him that much. But, yeah, I think it's kind of bold move time in terms of, because I think you've got a chance, if you can shore that up, you've got a chance to be back in this playoff conversation next year. You should be back in the playoff conversation. Like, I think when we get to next spring, we should anticipate them being in a race for a postseason berth. You know, I don't think it should be it ought to be a surprise, and I think it'll be a disappointment if they're not in that position next year. So, yeah, I think you're bang on, and the only thing is, you know, I don't know what the value of those catching prospects is, for instance, to the rest of baseball. Like, you know, we've all kind of signed off on Reese McGuire here and said, yeah, we've seen enough. But does he have any value? You know, do you have to trade, you know, Mercado, your top 10 guy? How good is he? How sure are you that, you know, Alejandro's going to be a, you know, is he really a major league player? It's, again, it's about what you know and what other people know or don't know, and it is complicated. I know I'm going on a long time here, but it's complicated by the fact there's been no minor league season. So it's not like you're showcasing these guys right now. They're off in the, you know, the mystery alternate training site in Rochester doing whatever they're doing.
Do you think we see Vladdy at first again the rest of the season? Or is he just going to sit in that DH spot?
I hope not. It's tricky, again, because you would like to cycle other people through the DH spot. And, you know, I don't think Telles is coming back, but it... You know, I'll tell you something. I used to, for many years, I worked with a guy in broadcasting who was a great baseball fan and knew a lot about baseball. And he would say all the time, anybody can play first base. That you can, that's where you put a guy who can't really play the field. I think we have now seen the counter argument. Not anybody can play first base. And look, I'll give Vladdy some rope here because, you know, they did the position switch. Before this shortened season, he thought he was a third baseman in spring training. He has much to learn, but I wish I could see him getting better. I wish I had seen him getting better. There's not a lot of time for mentoring in practice, is there? Like this is a rush job. But I hope everybody appreciates how good Justin Smoke was.
Oh,
just in terms of footwork, just watching. You know, it's a weird thing to say, but. Don't watch the glove, watch the feet. This is a guy who is learning and struggling, and it's hurt the team. It's cost them arguably what, 3 games? You know, I think you can make the case it's probably directly has cost them 3 games his play at first base. With a good first baseman there, plays would have been made. So that's a lot in a 60 game season.
Stephen Brunn is our guest on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We don't have a lot of time for NFL stuff, and I'll stay away from the onside kick in the Dallas game. I think we'll keep it to relatively local here.
Yes, sir.
Josh Allen yesterday, Buffalo over Miami. I know it was a relatively close game, the Dolphins scoring late to bring it to and then converting a 2-point conversion to make it a 3-point win for Buffalo. They recovered the onside kick attempt by the Dolphins and locked it down. That's all there. Josh Allen and Stephon Diggs forming a nice little tandem here. But I think the most important thing, Stephen, is the accuracy yesterday of Josh Allen's ball. If this guy is putting that together, it bodes very, very well for a Buffalo team that I think talent-wise, when you consider all of the opt-outs on that New England roster for COVID-19, I think this Buffalo team has the group to win the AFC East.
Yeah, I think so. Well, that was the unanswered question was, you know, the Josh Allen taking the step. And so far against two crappy opponents, you always have to put that in, you know, the two not good teams. He looked very good yesterday, obviously. I want to see them play New England. I know New England gave up a ton of yards last night in the end and lost, but they could have won. And, you know, I think the stories of New England's demise were, you know, somewhat exaggerated. That's a good football team still, even with the defections, even with Brady gone. You know, they played a terrific Seattle team right down to the wire last night, and Cam Newton looks comfortable. And so let's see. I want to see Buffalo play somebody good. But I agree with you. I just don't think – I think the king is not quite dead yet. And let's see. And yeah. I look forward to that matchup will be – I haven't even looked at the schedule. But that matchup, you still got to beat him, right? And I think Belichick and his mulleted son, you know, I think they've got something going for them there. I was impressed by them last night, even in the loss.
I've never seen an outside linebackers coach get TV time the way Steve Belichick has. I wonder if it's the last name or the hair, or both.
The Joe Dirt look. Yeah,
I'll tell you this though. The Rams are coming to Buffalo on Sunday, so that'll be a really good test for the Bills. The Patriots games home on November the 1st, and then they are at New England on December the 28th. So those will be the two, I guess, tell-all stories, right, in the AFC East.
I think so. I wonder if there'll be fans in either of those games. But, you know, it's interesting watching the crowds creep back in certain places, isn't it? Like, you know, you normally would think of the home and away being pretty significant in those New England-Buffalo games. But, you know, right now in ghost stadiums, it doesn't matter. I wonder. I wonder if they'll be ghost stadiums by the time they play those games.
It'll be fascinating to watch. We'll do this again next week, Stephen. Always enjoy it. Thank you.
All right. See you guys.
You bet. Stephen Brunt, one of the co-hosts of Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch, 3 to 5 each afternoon right here on Sportsnet 590, the Fan Baseball Central with Blair and Barker, 2 to 3 o'clock. And keep listening for that. The Blue Jays with the win yesterday. So their magic number to clinch a playoff spot is down to 4. We'll discuss that with John Paul Morosi. The surprise retirement of Tigers manager Ron Gardenhire, an old pal of ours, Josh Donaldson, got run in a Twins-White Sox game late last week. He says umpires are not being held accountable. Oh, JD. JD. We'll get into that and so much more. John Paul Morosi next. Jeff from Oakville texts in to 590-590. Really enjoyed the golf this weekend, and Wolf dropping the F-bombs on live U.S. TV as it all started falling apart. What you get with no crowd and the mic's up close, Sig.
The bad words. You gotta watch what you say.
Well, who cares?
Yeah, I like the kind of no filter, and I think they should do the two different broadcasts. You have the one regular broadcast, and they should not just golf, do it with all the sports. And then you have another broadcast where you just have all the mics are all hot and it picks up everything, and you got to go and
how many people would get into trouble really, really quickly? Because there are some,
that's the thing. I know there's some things said, but I mean, yeah, I mean, what is for the swearing during
the play? Swearing? Yeah, I don't care about that. I'm just saying there are some people from certain viewpoints who aren't that bright, and their use of certain words could put them into trouble is all I'm saying. But I'm down for it. F-bombs, SH-bombs, you name it. Take it off the terrestrial grid, man. Just play it live. I'm with you. That's the kids out of the room channel. Get the kids out of the room channel.
You pay an extra $100 a week or whatever, and you get all the audio.
Pay an extra $100 a week. $400 a month for the right to hear golfers and athletes swear.
Like, I bet you there would be a market for the NHL if you had all the audio that was picked up during a game.
I like that. Okay.
If it was just live.
I'll throw this out there. Would you pay $5,200 a year, $100 extra a week?
Don't say it like that. Don't say it like that.
Swear.
You say
on
the number.
On a special swearing channel.
You say 5,200. You got to say it's like whatever.
For the price of a cup of coffee a day, you could listen to your favorite golfers drop F-bombs.
Yeah, if you say like $15 a day, you can listen to whatever you want during your broadcast. I think that's the way to put it.
Shelve the lattes.
5,200.
Shelve the lattes and buy the swearing. John Paul Morosi of MLB Network is with us now. Sorry to put you through that. How are you?
Good morning. I think we would call that Nat sound here in the business, right?
Yes.
The natural sound of the environment.
No, so I'm trying to think. I want to see, I would pay $5,200 a year for a John Morosi meltdown channel. I don't picture you as being a guy who has meltdowns, but like if you're kicking a report on a pre-tape, John, and it's your third or fourth take and you're cranky, it's been a long day of travel, you haven't had dinner yet, you're hungry and you're angry, I'd pay to see a Morosi meltdown. You give us a YouTube clip that would live forever.
They happen. Meltdowns happen for all of us, myself included. I will tell you one quick story of a meltdown. I was this is a big surprise. I was a very bad high school athlete, and that included playing quarterback on an 0-9 football team my senior year.
The Detroit Lions.
And there was one time. this is pretty good. There was one time when an official came over to me after I had been sacked for approximately the 10th time in the game, and I was using a lot of very spicy language to address my linemen and pleading with them to prevent me from getting sacked for an 11th time, and I probably had some unprintable words in there. And I think it was the back judge who came over to me and said, hey, 12, if you keep swearing at your own lineman, I'm going to give you a personal foul and throw you out of the game. True story.
And you're thinking to yourself, that'll save me from injury. So you told
right,
your...
Exactly. I said, this sounds pretty appealing right now. Maybe I should keep doing this.
Told your left tackle to bleep off, and that's why you're standing in one piece.
I would have walked off the field a hero. But that thought... prescient though it may have been, that never quite occurred to me in the moment.
All right, so the Blue Jays won a baseball game yesterday, and their magic number to clinch over the Mariners, because the Mariners are the closest team on the outside looking in, is down to 4. So any combination of Blue Jays wins, Mariners losses, it adds up to 4, and Toronto's got a playoff spot. But I'm just going to rhyme off the last 10 games records for these teams that are in the final playoff spot conversation in the American League. The Blue Jays are 3-7. In their last 10. The Mariners are 4-6. Cleveland is 3-7. Detroit is 3-7. Baltimore is 3-7. Is this a compelling argument against the notion of expanded playoffs?
Well, Scott, it is on some level. Competitively speaking, it's possible that we'll have a team or two that makes the field that's under 500. Of course, that has happened with some degree of frequency in the NBA in recent years, and obviously, depending on how you calculate the points with the NHL, it's a different conversation a little bit there. But I think the commissioner seems to me to be fairly resolute that we're going to continue to have expanded playoffs, and I think that in general, that it's a good thing for the game. I think it's in general a good thing that even as the Jays are 26-26, that our conversation on the air this morning in Toronto is about a playoff bound team in all likelihood, as opposed to what's wrong with the Blue Jays and why would they have to make some big changes this winter. Really, the only thing separating us from that conversation today is the change in playoff format, because if it weren't for that, they would not be right now really close to the Yankees or a playoff berth if it was the old five teams making it format. So I think it's a good change for the game because it stimulates more discussion about the sport. I get it that competitively it's not maybe the most exclusive club now to make the postseason, but I also think that the way the playoffs are structured will force the Jays to have to go through one of the top couple teams in the league in the first round, and they'll have to earn their way through this the hard way. So I think it's, in general, a good format change. It's going to expand some excitement, and I think will lead to better spending by clubs in the future, which is really important at the time when there'll be a lot of reasons for teams to not spend. But I totally get it that right now, with the Jays sitting at 26-26 and somewhat mystifyingly not playing as well since they've had both Teoscar and Bo in the lineup at the same time after both had missed time, it has been certainly the last week or so a frustrating time for the Jays and their fans.
So John, if the playoff format as we understand it to be this year is to continue, and I'm not saying there can't be tweaks, but that is to say that, for example, a 106 win Yankees team could end up playing a 79-win Blue Jays or Orioles or whatever in a three-game series. Is there any justice in a team that has 30 to 35 more wins than another team potentially dropping what would be the equivalent of a July three-game series? You lose 2 out of 3, boom, you're done, and your 106 wins don't mean a thing.
Isn't, and you're right about that, and it's the same argument that I think we've seen in recent years in the NFL, where you'll have division winners at 7-9, you know, hosting a wild card team that's had a much better record than that. Certainly, it is not fair, but this is one consequence of going down the line of expanding the playoffs and trying to stimulate more discussion and more excitement in a greater number of markets. I totally get that. One way to potentially work around that, Scott, would be if they potentially went to a seven-team format and gave a bye to the top seed. So then you would have the first round of the playoffs would be bye for that Yankees team that you're describing, and then the remaining six teams would play to then get a berth into the division series. That is one possibility. So that basically you would have one fewer series in each league in that initial round of best of three. That's one possibility, and I think that there's a decent case to be made that that's a fair way to do it. I would also point out that we've seen it happen many times, not that it's necessarily a compelling or determinative counter-argument, that the top seed, when they play the wild card game winner, it's basically a coin flip at that point in time. We saw it again happen last year with the Nationals beating the Dodgers. I mean, there's so many times the team that's hot and wins that abbreviated round or in past years a one game is almost liberated by having won that tense situation and plays better in the best of five and beats the top seed. So there's probably no optimal way to do it. But I think, Scott and Mike, I would just say that in general, this is one thing that has manifestly changed in the game in recent years. Teams spend money based on the algorithms that tell them how good of a chance they have to either make the playoffs or advance in the playoffs. That is a fact. And that algorithm changes when it's a best of three that you're competing for as opposed to potentially a wild card game. It's not ideal, but that calculation, that number, that algorithm drives so many decisions in the sport that being able to, I think, alter the odds of that algorithm, as technical and as nerdy as that might sound, is going to have a tremendously exciting effect on the way that teams spend in the offseason, and I think is worth the task and the potential downside of that overall effort.
What did you make of Josh Donaldson kicking dirt on the home plate and just ripping the umpire? Of umpires, plural, actually.
JD at his best, man. JD at his best.
I make of it that I know that Josh Donaldson. I've had a conversation with that Josh Donaldson before. That he has not changed, obviously, with his competitive instinct. I may not agree with a lot of what he said, but no one's ever going to say that Josh, please tell us what you really think, or we need you to be more authentic. And again, this circles back to I think in its own way to a similar line of thought to the playoff conversation, is that I think that players being authentic and speaking their minds is a manifestly good thing for the sport. And then you can't then say, hey, I want the players to speak their minds, and then when they say something controversial, say, wait a minute, I want you to edit that. I don't want you to say that, actually. No, I want Josh to say what's on his mind. And I've always enjoyed his perspective. I've always enjoyed our conversations. And he's someone that I think has, after injuries, really willed himself back into being a very, very forceful hitter on the field, and certainly a great personality off of it as well. So I have tremendous respect for the work of the umpires. I think that the vast majority of them do a tremendous job virtually every night with very little fanfare. I also think that it's important for players to speak their minds, and even though Josh and I have probably some disagreements about the overall caliber of umpiring, I certainly stand by his ability to express that opinion to anybody who cares to hear it.
Ron Gardenhire is a name that diehard baseball fans will be familiar with. I, if you're kind of a passing fan in Toronto, you may not know, but he was the longtime manager of the Minnesota Twins, and for the last couple of years, he has been the manager of the rebuilding Detroit Tigers, so he works in your backyard, John. He announced effectively a snap retirement over the weekend, citing health concerns. I don't know what you know, and if you do, what it is you can divulge, and we'll certainly respect Ron's privacy if that's what he wishes for at this time, but how worrying is his situation?
Well, I think that, first of all, I don't know really much more than what's been divulged publicly. I mean, I think it's, to me, just a case of, as he has said, he's burned out, he has been stressed. He referenced in his press conference over the weekend that his hands have been shaking here in recent days. He had a recent bout with food poisoning, that it just seems as though the stress of the job, and of course he's a cancer survivor himself, that just the overall physical and mental toll of it, especially during this year, just was adding up. And I think there was a time when the Tigers were giving a lot of thought to having him come back next year and be the manager as the rebuild hopefully takes another step or two forward from the Tigers' perspective. But I think the overall circumstances, the pressures of having to manage during a year like this was adding up. And I think that, to his point, he just decided it was time to take care of his health. And I think that's and spend time with his family, with his grandkids, and look for that life after the daily grind of baseball. So it's my hope that he'll still be involved in the game in some way, and I think that as long as his health permits, my hope is that he will be, whether it's managing a Team USA down the line at a World Baseball Classic. I think he would be great at that, as Jim Leland was last time around. Gardies is a tremendous person who has the love of countless people in the game, tremendous storyteller, self-deprecating humor, always loyal to his players. I know Justin Morneau talked over the weekend about what Gardy had meant to him. So he's someone that I have always cherished my interactions with him. I remember just years ago at a winter meetings, he was there in mid-conversation with somebody, and I kind of waved at him from a distance, and all of a sudden he sort of asked to excuse himself for a quick moment with who he was talking with, and just raced over and gave me a quick handshake and said, "Hey, John, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays," and then went back to his conversation. He's just a very thoughtful person. He's a very caring person who's been a great ambassador for the sport. And I really believe, Scott and Mike, that he'll be back in some capacity in the game, whether it's as a special assistant or maybe managing a special event like the WBC. But he's someone who's made the game better just by being his genuine self.
And last one for you, John. Justin Verlander has announced on his Instagram page that he needs Tommy John surgery. So my question isn't specifically about Verlander. It's about the pitchers who take some time after suffering the initial elbow injury, and that period of time can be months, and it's been a couple of months for Verlander here, who take a couple of months and then go and get the surgery. I would imagine that they are exploring other options to try to heal the thing, because the surgery itself takes at least 12 months from which to recover. But if you've got the torn UCL in your elbow, don't you want to get that thing out of the way so you can start the rehab process?
Well, it's a great question, and here's how I would answer it. It depends on the pitcher, and it depends on the severity of the tear. I would point out Masahiro Tanaka's pitched with a partial UCL tear for years now, years. And so it depends on probably the age of the pitcher, the contract, the circumstances. In Tanaka's case, he's been able to rehab it, and we now know platelet-rich plasma injections work for some pitchers, not for everybody, but for some. And so I think it depends also where you're at with the calendar. If you get this news in February and you feel like if you have the surgery and if it's a pretty significant tear, you have the surgery, you're back by spring training or early the next season, I think in many cases at that point it makes sense to have the surgery. If in Verlander's case it was late July when he had the initial arm injury, and then you look at it and say, okay, well, if you have the surgery now, you're probably out for most, if not all, of the following season anyway, and maybe you're hoping to come back for September, or if it's a 14-month recovery, you're probably done for next year anyway. It seemed like where he was at in the calendar in this particular instance, Scott, that it made sense for him to just give it one last chance to see if he could rehab it and be a contributor down the stretch, especially for a team that might be on the verge of losing George Springer and kind of hitting a reset button anyway. So I think this decision to try to rehab it and come back this year was very pitcher and team specific and calendar specific, where it made sense to try. I get why he tried, but at this point in time, to your point, he's now out for all of next year. He'll be a free agent, and it's going to be a question of, for Justin, at age 38, 39, what does that look like, and where does he go from here? So I think it's going to be a very interesting decision for him, for where he wants to pitch and what the landscape looks like in baseball in the world by opening day of 2022.
Great stuff, John. We'll talk again next week, and we'll know the playoff matchups. Can't wait.
Really enjoy the conversation. I expect the Jays to be there, so I'm going to be optimistic. I know it was a tough six-game losing streak, but they're going to be there. I'm confident of that, and playoff baseball, back in for Canadian fans here in the weeks to come.
John Paul Morosi of MLB Network. Hugh is in the studio. Who the heck is playing and when? Next. All right, Hugh Burrell, for great Canadian meat. Who the heck is playing and when?
I'll tell you, Scotty Mac. At 6:30, it all begins on Sportsnet with the NHL Awards. Find out who won what. 6:30, Sportsnet. Also at 6:30, the Yankees and Jays begin a pivotal series. Well, not really a pivotal series, but an important series for the Jays. 6:30, Sportsnet 1 and Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Then at 8 o'clock, it's the Stars and Lightning. Dallas trying to go 2 up on Tampa. Sportsnet and CBC. And at 8:30 on this very show, 8:30 a.m., this morning, as opposed to p.m. this morning, Deputy Commissioner Bill Daly will field questions from you and Ziggy.
It's p.m. somewhere, Hugh.
It is. It really is.
Somewhere far, far east from here.
Yeah.
Can't wait to talk to Bill Daly at 8:30. Ross Tucker of the Ross Tucker Football Podcast, week 2 of the NFL, almost in the books. The injuries are mounting. We'll get Ross's take on those and some of the key plays and the key games from yesterday, coming up. Now, this is for Ross Tucker, big Taylor Swift fan.
He is a big Taylor Swift fan?
Absolutely.
How do you know that?
I don't know. Silent Vic just knows stuff. He takes requests.
I don't think Ross Tucker listens to this.
We'll ask him here in just a moment. Nothing wrong with Taylor Swift. You know what? There is something wrong with all the injuries in the NFL. I don't know if this is...
Oh, my goodness.
I don't know if it just
what is
feels,
happening?
I don't know if it just feels different, or if we're more focused on it because we're coming out of COVID with no preseason, and so we've developed some conclusions in our own mind that are now being confirmed by what we see, or if this is just kind of run-of-the-mill stuff because football's a violent game. But we'll get into it now with our buddy Ross Tucker, our NFL analyst on a Monday morning. The Ross Tucker Football Podcast, always worth a listen. It's daily. And the Even Money Podcast as well. Ross, did you come out of the weekend unhurt? Because that would make you and a couple of others the exceptions.
Yeah, I feel good. I feel good for a lot of reasons. Number one, yesterday was an unbelievably entertaining day of football at every time slot, which I love. And number two, as you mentioned on the Even Money podcast, that's the one where we pick against the spread, I am up 6 units. So okay. Very, very happy for my listeners of the Even Money podcast that I'm up 6 units, even though the Steelers totally blew it for me. I was laying 6.5 points with the Steelers, and they blew it. There's no way when Drew Lock got hurt, speaking of the injuries, that they shouldn't have won by more than that. But that's okay. I'm still up 6 units for the week, which is good for me and good for my listeners.
All right, we got a lot to get to. So let's start with the injuries. And look, you mentioned Drew Lock. Christian McCaffrey went down with an ankle in the Carolina loss at Tampa Bay. Saquon Barkley injured in the Giants road loss at Chicago. Devontae Adams of Green Bay, hammy in the Packers win over the Lions. You know me, though, Ross. I'm going to focus on the 49ers, but I'm going to say this. It's not just a 49ers thing. It was also a Jets thing. The Jets and Niners played at MetLife yesterday, and players came out of that game saying that turf isn't safe. Now, the Niners lost Nick Bosa likely to a torn ACL for the rest of the year. Solomon Thomas may be the same thing. Jimmy Garoppolo suffered a high ankle sprain. Raheem Mostert left at halftime with a knee problem, didn't come back out. The Jets had a couple of injuries too. Is there something going on with the MetLife Stadium turf that needs to be addressed before the Giants host the 49ers next Sunday?
Well, I'm sure they're going to look into it. That's for sure. Although, if you guys remember, last Monday night, I was actually in the booth for the Steelers and the Giants for Monday Night Football, I didn't really notice anything in that game. I mean, I guess late in the fourth quarter, Zach Banner, the right tackle for the Steelers, tore his ACL as he was trying to brace late in the game. But that's really the only, you know, injury, lower body injury, turf-related injury of note that I remember from that game. So I don't know. I mean, if those guys are all saying that and they were saying it before the game, it sounds like there might be something to it. But there was another game played there 6 days earlier, and there wasn't really a rash of injuries. So I think it's kind of hard for me to sit here and think that, you know, that it's clearly – I mean, even like Nick Bosa, he got bent over. You know, I mean, and I guess you could say maybe his cleat stuck in the turf, but it wasn't like it was like non-contact turf injuries out there.
Well, I'm – and I saw your tweet about this, so I want to go down this path with you for just a couple of minutes. You tweeted yesterday that a lot of the NFL players you had spoken to leading up to the season were less concerned about catching COVID, and the league so far has done a very good job at keeping COVID out of its bubble, for lack of a better way to describe it. They were more concerned about long-term injuries, and those are cropping up. Do you equate some of what's going on here, Ross, with the fact that there were no preseason games and guys are going from essentially zero in practice to 100 in games that count? Or is this just football? It's a violent game. Sometimes you're going to get hit and hurt, and other times you're going to get rolled on, and other things happen that you just can't avoid.
I think it's more just football, to be honest with you. I mean, number one, if it was a major issue, first of all, most of the guys that are getting hurt, Saquon Barkley, Nick Bosa, they wouldn't play in the preseason anyway. You know, so I don't think that's much of an impact. And not only that, if that were the issue, I think that there would have been more of a rash of injuries in week one, right? I mean, the first time actually going out there, you know, they already all have a game under their belt. I think it was one of those. I think it was an anomaly. I really do. I mean, there are injuries every week, and we note them every week. I think what happened was to have Bosa and Saquon Barkley and Drew Lock, a starting quarterback, all go down within like the first 30 minutes. It then became sort of the narrative and the storyline for the rest of the day, and rightfully so. I mean, listen, I just recorded the Ross Tucker Football Podcast, and that's what I started my show with. I mean, that was one of the big themes or big takeaways from the day were the injuries. But I don't think it was – I don't think that there's a bigger thing in play here. I think it happened to be a few star players that got it. It's unfortunate. It's awful. It's the worst part of the sport. And, you know, it kind of all happened at the same time, which made us all kind of take a step back and think, what is going on? But they were, I mean, like, Drew Lock hurt his shoulder. I mean, that doesn't have anything to do with anything, right, other than how he got hit and landed on it. So there's just a lot of different ways you can take it. But it's not like it was any I don't think – I would say there's not like a trend, right? And I think if it were the preseason thing – it'd be more soft tissue injuries like the Adams hammy.
You played on some of the worst turf back in your day, Ross, that could be imagined. They've done a good job in advancing this. Baseball's doing it too. In fact, some teams are going back from natural grass to the artificial turf. The Arizona Diamondbacks have done it, the Miami Marlins. It looks like real grass on TV, but it's not. So they've made great advances in this. I can only imagine you got stories from back when you played. Did you play at the vet?
I did. Yeah, that was actually so. This is
like
a funny
story. That was awful. So
I'm from outside of Philadelphia. I'm from Wyomissing, Pennsylvania, which, by the way, is the hometown of Taylor Swift, which may have something to do with me being a big Taylor Swift fan.
Taylor's great. Don't apologize for it.
Yeah, I know her dad really well. We're buddies. So anyway, he's a big football guy, believe it or not. So I grew up a huge Eagles fan. So as a rookie, it was the first game I ever suited up because there was an injury the week before. was at Philadelphia at the Vet against the Eagles. And it was an unbelievable feeling because we're driving in on the team bus and I've got like 8-year-olds giving me the middle finger as we're driving in, giving our team buses the middle finger. And I just thought, oh,
sounds
yes,
like Philly.
I'm home. I'm home. I'm back. This is where I belong. And then to be out there, it was just hard as a rock. I mean, the Vet was hard as a rock. And we actually won the game, which was great. But it's just kind of funny. It's just surreal to be on the away team bus driving into a stadium that I've been to so many. I mean, I've been to so many Eagles games, so many Phillies games. And now I'm the one on the bus getting the finger from the 8-year-olds. It's crazy.
With Ross Tucker, the Ross Tucker Football Podcast, the Even Money Podcast. It's the Monday morning after the Sunday that was NFL Week 2. Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
The Buffalo Bills are now 2-0 to start the season. Josh Allen becomes the fourth quarterback in NFL history with 700-plus yards and 6 or more touchdowns in the first 2 weeks. Do you need to see better them play better teams, or has this team taken the next step from where they were last year?
I don't – well, that's a good question, actually. I think – can I say both? Can I say I'd like to see how they do against better teams, but I do think they've taken the next step. They've taken the next step because Josh Allen's taken the next step. I mean, getting Stephon Diggs, and he paid huge dividends yesterday, as we all saw, and to have Josh Allen do what he just did with the crazy statistics. He, by the way, is unbelievably entertaining. Like that one run where he almost got the first down where he trucked like three dudes, he's hilarious. I mean, Josh, I can't ever remember a time, guys, where there are this many quarterbacks that, like, you have to watch them. Lamar Jackson, Deshaun Watson, Patrick Mahomes, Russell Wilson, Cam Newton. And I put Josh Allen in that mix for, like, you got to watch that dude. I mean, he is unbelievably entertaining. He made some ridiculous throws. So I do think they've taken the next step, because Josh Allen's taken the next step. But I am still curious to see how they do against some of these other teams, right? Like, I think pretty clearly Baltimore and Kansas City are the class of the AFC. What I'm curious about is how close Pittsburgh and Buffalo are to them and if they could give them a run for their money in the playoffs. I kind of think they could. You know, with Big Ben and Josh Allen, I kind of think that those teams are capable of beating Baltimore and Kansas City in the playoffs.
Well, I think Buffalo gets a nice test this Sunday. It's not a rival by any stretch of the imagination, opposite conference, Ross, but the Rams are going into Buffalo. I think that's a pretty good early telltale sign of where you're at, because L.A. is out of the gate really nicely.
Rams were so impressive yesterday. You know, I do the Eagles pregame, and I do their preseason television, so I watch them very closely. Wow. I mean, Sean McVay was one step ahead of Eagles D coordinator Jim Schwartz the entire game, especially in the first half. I mean, the ball didn't hit the ground. It was like play action pass, wide open tight end touch. I mean, it almost at times looked like the Rams were playing 7-on-7. It was that easy for them. Thoroughly impressed by the Rams. Was not expecting them to take it to the Eagles like they did.
Ross Tucker is with us on Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Do you think we're going to see a new trend now of onside kicks when they happen? No tee, and the ball placed perpendicular to the 35-yard line. Greg Zuerlein, the way that I saw that play out, Ross, was Atlanta didn't think it was going to go the 10 yards, so they backed off. They backed off, and then the English and the spin on the ball kicked it into a new gear, kind of as it squibbed toward the sideline, and it moved forward 10 yards. Dallas fell on it. Everybody's crapping on the Falcons, just fall on the football. But we all know with onside kicks that if the receiving team touches it and muffs it themselves, the ball is live. So I think that they thought it wasn't going to go 10 yards. They backed off, ended up paying the price for it.
Yeah, I don't think the criticism of the Falcons on the onside kick is really fair, because it did not look like it was going to go 10 yards. And yes, somebody could have gone up there and tried to recover it, But that thing was spinning. I think Zuerlein calls it the slippery watermelon or something like that. I don't know. He had some great name for it, you know, the whatever watermelon. And think about how dumb it would have looked if they went up to get it at 6 yards and they tried to get it and, you know, they mishandled it and then the Cowboys jumped at it. Everybody would have said, that wasn't going to go 10 yards. What are you doing? That yep. wasn't going to go 10 yards. So, yep. It was a great kick. It was unbelievable execution. I understand what the Falcons guys were thinking, and I don't really blame them for that. Other than, you know, right when it was at 10 yards, they needed to be right there, and they needed to be the one that jumped on it.
Well, we were talking, Ross, earlier about injuries on turf. I wonder if that's a kick you can make on grass. Dallas has the artificial turf, you know, so it's I would imagine, more certain for something like that. I wonder if you could pull that off on a grass field. If we'll see,
I have no idea. I have no idea how he did that. I mean, it looked like it was going to stop dead at, like, yeah. 6 yards. Yeah. I don't know how it, like, it made a right turn. It was, I mean, what some of these guys, like, it was not like this in terms of how good the kickers are and how good the punt. I mean, the punters can basically punt the ball anywhere they want, whenever they want, in terms of, like, coffin corner, directional punting. Kickers, I mean, we got Harrison, the butt kicker, going ahead and blasting 58 yarders, like, three in a row, two in a row, at the end of overtime. I mean, I'm thoroughly impressed. I've never been a big fan of the importance of that position in the sport, but I am so impressed by what those guys are able to do these days.
How about Cam Newton again this weekend? Thought he played great. When you're watching him yesterday, do you not, if you're Carolina, do you not say, man, how did we not just give him one last chance? Or is this just all Belichick?
No, that's exactly what I said. And you need to follow me on Twitter because that's exactly what I tweeted, at Ross Tucker NFL. All the Panthers fans are up in arms because they're saying, aren't you the guy that said you weren't sure he was going to start? I wasn't sure he was going to start in New England for a bunch of different reasons, including the fact that if Carolina cut him like they did, they must have thought his body was shot. He had nothing left. Well, evidently they were wrong. And I have said from the start, I would have played Cam this year in Carolina. He was in the last year of his contract, and it's the first year of a 6-year deal for Matt Rhule in Carolina. So why not get what I call, it's kind of like a betting term, like Even Money Podcast, a free roll. Why not get a free roll of Cam in the last year of his contract and see if he can be the guy that he used to be? And if he is, awesome. Then franchise tag him or try to get a long-term deal with him. If he gets hurt or if he's not, okay, then you probably have a bad season. You move on from Cam. You have a high pick and you take, you know, Trey Lance or Trevor Lawrence or Justin Fields or whoever, right? You take one of these top quarterbacks and that's your guy and you build around him, blah, blah, blah. Instead, they cut him and gave Teddy Bridgewater over $20 million guaranteed. Never really understood that from Carolina's perspective.
Who do you think will end up being in the running for one of those top young draftable quarterbacks, Ross? Because I'm looking at the 0-2 teams. Carolina, it occurs to me. Would Atlanta, if they shank it this year, look to move on from a Matt Ryan? But Cincinnati's got their guy in Joe Burrow, even if they go 2-14. Houston's got Deshaun Watson. They're not going to be awful, even though they're off to an 0-2 start. They've got an unprecedented tough schedule to begin. The Jets have Darnold. Would they move on from him? The Dolphins have Tagovailoa waiting in the wings. They're an 0-2 team right now. I am trying to figure out which teams will be looking for these quarterbacks.
Jets, for sure, I think would be in that mix. I think Carolina, absolutely. Potentially the Jags, although my man Minshew's playing great right now. Potentially the Bears, even though they're 2-0 right now. I don't expect that to last, and I think they could be in the mix. I do not think Atlanta would be in the mix. Matt Ryan was awesome again yesterday. It's unbelievable. He might be all time in NFL history the quarterback that's had the most good games in a losing effort for his team. It's uncanny.
Yeah, I'm thinking Phil Rivers, too. But he had a lot of good years in San Diego and on good teams. They just couldn't get it done in the playoffs. What do you think about a team? And again, we got 14 games to go here, so it's hard to make the hot takes stick. But, like, is Minnesota at 0-2? Are they going to recover from this? Kirk Cousins, and we got a great friend of ours who works at Sportsnet here who is worth a follow on Twitter every Sunday when his beloved Vikings take the field, who despises Kirk Cousins, Arash Madani, our good pal. Is Kirk Cousins, is he going to need to be replaced? Not this year necessarily, but ASAP if the Vikings are actually going to take the next step. Because I'm thinking as I'm watching Stephon Diggs catch balls from Josh Allen yesterday, Diggs must have been just so glad to be out of there.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I thought Kirk Cousins had a good season last year, a really good season. I thought he was one of the 10 best quarterbacks in the NFL. They won a playoff game in New Orleans. You know, by any measure, right, he's in the top half of the league. Now, he hasn't played that way so far this year. He's had a couple of bad games. Well, he was okay against Green Bay. He was just really bad yesterday. But he's in the top half of the league. He's under contract for several years, fully guaranteed. So I don't think he's going anywhere, and I don't advise teams to move on from a quarterback that's in the top half of the league unless they're sure they have someone better. You know, if you have a quarterback in the top half of the league, you hold on to him for dear life. Now, if the bottom falls out and he plays terrible all year and they have a top pick and maybe they can trade Kirk Cousins at that point, but under that scenario, who's really trading for Kirk Cousins at that point? That's the problem.
If you had to wear a haircut for a month, would you pick Mark Davis, the Vegas Raiders owner, or Steve Belichick's Kentucky Waterfall mullet?
Definitely Steve Belichick's. Belichick's is like hilarious. It's ironic. You know what I mean? It's like, you know that the guy is doing that on purpose, right? Or actually, even if he's not where I live in Pennsylvania, I live in central Pennsylvania, I'd kind of fit in with the Steve Belichick, to be honest with you. Meanwhile, the Mark Davis looks like something's going on. I mean, do you know that at one point, you guys got to look this up, they interviewed Mark Davis's hairstylist, or like she was on Twitter, and she's like, listen, that stop criticizing me. That's what he wants. I've tried to talk to him about it, but he refuses. That's what he wants.
It's his thing.
I mean, that's just good reporting right there. I mean, you get quotes from Mark Davis's hairstylist about his Dumb and Dumber haircut. It's amazing.
Yeah, the Lloyd Christmas and the white tracksuit. Nothing says I'm rich and don't give no bleeps like that. wow. Always good, Ross. We'll do it again next Monday. Appreciate your time. We'll be listening to the Even Money podcast and the Ross Tucker Football Podcast, as always. Can't wait to chat next week.
Sounds great. And if you're a fantasy dude, Fantasy Feast Podcast as well. See you guys.
Ross Tucker, the Deputy Commissioner of the NHL, Bill Daly. The awards go down tonight. Game 2 of the Stanley Cup Final goes down tonight. The league has maintained a relatively COVID-free status inside the bubble. What will the offseason and what will next season look like? A bunch of questions for Bill Daly. We'll ask him next.
I'm not the fan.
Game 2 of the Stanley Cup Final goes tonight after the NHL hands out some of its top awards. The league has done a really good job in keeping the players and everyone inside the bubble safe in this really weird, strange, and uncertain time, the result of the COVID-19 pandemic. To discuss that, what the offseason and what next season may look like and so much more, we welcome the Deputy Commissioner of the NHL, Bill Daly, to the program. Mr. Daly, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, guys. How are you?
I'm fire away. Okay. We're giving our technical director Silent Vic the out cue for the show. We always play a funny clip. Bill, we'll start with this, which is the last time you were on the program, you said that some of the COVID planning for the bubble was the most strenuous and time-consuming work of your time in the NHL's front office. All things considered, it has effectively gone off, at least from a layperson and an outsider's point of view, without a hitch. How would you describe the experience of the last two-plus months?
We're certainly very pleased with how it's gone. I've been now in the Edmonton bubble for, I guess, 3 weeks, and I just appreciate even more what these two teams have gone through, and all our the club staffs and the league staff and putting this together. It's a really huge commitment, they've done fantastic work, we're pleased to be in the Stanley Cup final. Was a great game on Saturday night. The quality of the hockey is really, really good. Hoping for six more really exciting games and we can award a Stanley Cup and we can take the bubble down for now.
Yeah, you have to be thrilled with the way the bubble system has gone. No positive tests, no delayed games. It's been watching it on TV, it's been just incredible from the production and everything. What's something that maybe the NHL overlooked or would have rather have done or added to the bubble that maybe you didn't think of when the playoffs did start?
It's a good question, and we kind of evaluate, and the question portends really that it's not perfect, and nothing about this whole situation is perfect. So are there things we would have done a little bit differently, maybe? Are there any prominent things I can think of? Not really. I mean, I think this is about what we anticipated. Certainly, from what I understand, I was never integrated in the Toronto bubble, so I don't really know what that's like. Apparently here, it's a little smaller, a little less to do, a little fewer options for the players on off days than the Toronto bubble offered. But we're at the stage of the playoffs where, their focus is really 100% on the ice and on winning games. So I don't think it's created a hardship. So we're chugging along.
With Bill Daly, the deputy commissioner of the NHL, this is Leadoff, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Do you have a sense yet, Deputy Commissioner, of when next season will start from an on-ice perspective?
I don't really have a good sense of that. We've started spending some time internally and with the Players Association on thinking about next year and thinking about what that looks like and when it starts and the like. I've been working with the Players Association on kind of an off-season program for clubs to begin opening their facilities and allowing players to come in for off-season training. But without kind of firm dates, it's very difficult for the players to kind of travel or to plan their travel for themselves and their families and when they'll be coming. It's just, obviously a strange time of the calendar for us and for them. We're really taking in all the data points we can possibly take in, whether it be what's going on in the National Football League or whether it's what's going on in collegiate athletics, both with respect to college football, but college hockey as well. What's going on with the European leagues. What the local health restrictions are in each of our markets. And we're doing some financial modeling, working with the clubs individually to figure that end out. And once we get through this, hopefully, knock on wood and award a Stanley Cup, we can turn our focus 100% to what next season looks like and what the timing is.
With NHL Deputy Commissioner Bill Daly on leadoff, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, I would imagine that a bubble for a regular season next year is less preferable to the traditional way of doing things. Do you need, as you plan this, do you need to come up with Model A, which is travel, non-bubble, and Model B, which is to say bubble? Because the one thing you're dealing with here, I think it's an obvious comment, is goodness only knows where we're at with this virus in 2 or 3 months. It could be one thing where you're healthy. We're all in a space where we can travel and do different things, Bill. Could be another situation where you've got to hunker down.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say you've got to consider alternatives. There's no doubt about that. And, I think we are, whether we've drilled down as, we certainly haven't drilled down as much as we're going to need to. But, there are so many, to your point, Scott, I think there's so many variables that we can't control for necessarily, particularly, what the border crossings are going to look like and the quarantines and all of those issues that go into, how you can execute a professional sports league season are going to be relevant. So, we get a lot of work ahead of us. There's no doubt about that.
It's no secret the NHL is a gate-driven league and that the majority of the revenue comes from that, or a big chunk of it. How long can you actually delay the start of next season to give the NHL the best chance to have fans attend games again?
Well, I think that is, the reason we delay beyond, right now we're tentatively – we had tentatively agreed with the Players Association to aim for a December 1st season start. But that was always a notional date that is, subject to a lot of, variation based on kind of where the world sits at that time. Our delay of the season would be to preserve the ability to generate additional revenue through fans in the stands, and fans in the arenas. That's important to us and our sport, even beyond the revenue impact it has. I think it's a critical part of how our game is played and what makes it appealing to fans, is the enthusiasm in the arena. So, we're gonna do our best to try to get as many fans in our buildings next season as possible, but we're gonna also do it safely.
Do you think you are compelled more to seek out potential revenue streams that are considered newer or a little different? I know the single game gambling and whatnot, leagues are jumping in head first on this now that some of the restrictions are being lifted, and that would be a nice way to generate even more revenue. I'm thinking if gates are closed, Bill, there's going to have to be ways to make up for maybe not all, but some of that lost revenue. How creative are you finding yourself, the people you work with, needing to be here to deal with a potential offset of the lost gate revenue?
Well, I always like to think that our people are as creative as possible to maximize revenues, because I think we're all, we all have, an intention to maximize revenue. So that doesn't really change from non-pandemic to pandemic. I guess what could change is, are there revenue opportunities that you can discover that are available to you uniquely because of the pandemic situation. While it's not, a revenue opportunity per se, I mean, the fact of the matter is the way we're producing these games in the bubble and all the different camera views and a lot of the different technologies we're using are technologies that aren't really can't really be utilized when we have full buildings because of fans in the seats and camera location and the like. So you have to try to be as creative as you can within the circumstances under which you're playing your games to make the game as compelling as it can be. And by doing so, generate additional revenue.
If the NHL doesn't go to a bubble system like they did for the playoffs this year, do you see something happening where all the Canadian teams play each other for, you know, 10, 11 games and then, or half the teams then go to the U.S. for, I think, what is it now? 9 days is as long as you can be on the road, right? I'm not sure if they've changed that, but then they go maybe 2 or 3 weeks into the U.S. play and then come back.
So that's a great question, and I can only say maybe, right? So I'm not really in a position to rule anything out, and you know what we end up doing will very much be dictated by, you know, what the rules are, what the circumstances are, where the world has evolved to, you know, we do have the benefit of some time. To continue to observe and to continue to obtain data points and so we can make the best decisions we can possibly make. You know, we did the same thing, you know, when we announced our return to play and the concept for the bubbles, you know, but took all the time really that was available to us to make the decision as to where those bubbles were going to be. And I view this to be very similar to that, where we really should take our time. We shouldn't jump into solutions before we know, before we really have to, because, you know, we should take all the time that's available to us to make the best decisions possible.
From a personal perspective, Mr. Deputy Commissioner, what's it like? I mean, you're living it in Edmonton. You've experienced it. Is it, I mean, with some restrictions, life has kind of become routine. It's comfortable. You understand, or is it one of those things where you're like, geez, deep down, I'm looking forward to getting out of here. There's only a certain amount of time I can put up with this.
Well, as I said off the top, I think it's an enormous commitment, and I am very appreciative and sensitive to that. I mean, people being away from their families, people not really having interaction with the outside world, and that's what it is. But you know, to your point, is it, you know, do I feel like I'm in prison? No, I don't. You know, I have, you know, there's a life, there's a daily routine. And that's what I'll call it. It's really a routine you get into, where it becomes somewhat monotonous day in and day out. But it's perfectly, you know, livable, fine, comfortable, good restaurants, you know, the beer tastes good. So, you know, it's certainly something that I can live with.
Where is the league at right now in terms of future plans to participate in and continue to promote the need for social justice and racial equality in our society?
Well, you know, given the pandemic and all that's gone on, that's been a very important part of what we've, you know, been dealing with. You know, the world is in a different place than it was at the start of the pandemic. And certainly it's raised attention and put attention and focus on areas, on different areas and different priorities. And I think that's a good thing. And that certainly exists in the National Hockey League and for the National Hockey League as well, and for our players. And I think we've been active in this space for a while, but certainly what's going on in the world enhances that attention, and as it should. And we accept that responsibility. We want to move in that direction, and certainly we want to do our part.
Mr. Daly, thank you so much for this. Great to chat, great to catch up. We wish you and the league continued success. It's been a wildly successful bubble. The Stanley Cup will be awarded here very soon. Dallas or Tampa Bay will take it home, and we'll be in touch as the offseason rolls on.
That's great. Thanks for having me, guys.
Bill Daly. Bill Daly is the deputy commissioner of the NHL. We'll get you set for a good show. Final thought on the U.S. Open on the weekend that was in the NFL. And the Blue Jays' magic number down to 4 to clinch a playoff spot. I can't believe I'm saying that. It's all coming up. Nine number unsigned. Is Ross Tucker as good a promoter as Dana White?
It's close.
It's not bad.
Guy does everything.
He snuck the Fantasy Feast in there too. I was pumping hell.
It's a new one
out of the Ross Tucker Football Podcast, and
we got a Twitter handle as well.
Yes, we got a Twitter
handle. Was new today. That was new.
No. He's done that before. At Ross Tucker handle? NFL, and I'm happy to be. He's awesome. I love having him on.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah, but a lot of my buddies message me. Love listening to him.
Yeah, and knows his stuff, obviously. But yes, is very good at the promotion. You got to be.
I wanted to ask him. I know we ran out of time, but did Carson Wentz get booed yesterday?
Did Carson in the stands?
No, but they piped in.
They piped in booing.
Was it the game at home?
Yeah, well, but Philly.
It is Philadelphia.
Philly will boo. Eagles fans would not have been treating their team well.
What's that old saying about Philadelphia fans? They boo Santa Claus.
Well, they booed Santa Claus.
And safe landings.
Yeah, and Michael Irvin, and now Dallas Cowboys, I get it. But like Michael Irvin, his career ended on the turf of Veterans Stadium when he broke his neck.
Yeah.
And they booed him off the field. Now, they didn't know he had a broken neck at the moment, but it was a serious injury. Dude was carted off.
The indelible image that I have of that is Michael Irvin being stretchered off the field in Philadelphia, and fans were throwing batteries at him. Welcome to Philly.
He got booed. You want to know a Philadelphia fan is when the guy caught the baby out of the burning building, and he was doing the interview after, was this last year, year and a half ago? And he said, oh, yeah, I don't drop the ball like whoever the wide receiver was at the time in Philly. Who was the wide receiver? Whoever it was.
You know they've got.
Alshon Jeffrey. Was it Alshon Jeffrey? Yeah.
Who was it?
Aguilar. That's right.
Yeah.
No, but they've got a makeshift courthouse, like courtroom in the bowels of Lincoln Financial Field, the Eagles Stadium.
Of course
to
they do.
They put in a judge and they just. Here, this person just got pissed up in the 500 level and committed a misdemeanor. Fine him or throw him in the clink. Like, efficiency, baby. Oh, that's what it is.
Love those fans.
Night in the piss tank. Fly, Eagles, fly. Not so much so far this year. We are back at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. Will the Blue Jays' magic number be down from the 4 that it is right now? Hopefully, they've got the Yankees for a 4-game series starting tonight on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, and Sportsnet. We will talk to you at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. Good show is next. Enjoy your Bruno Caboclo day. We're 2 days away from being 2 days away from the weekend.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
I'm fire away. Okay.
I